In the 3 days before her court-martial, Esme had to record her initial statements for the other trials, including Commander Serrano's. In his office, Chapin explained,
"Everything's unusual about this. They had a time finding enough officers to sit on this many different boards and courts at once, and they're short of space, too. So they're shuffling people in spaces and decided that since you're in such demand, they can, after all, accept recorded testimony for some of it. With any luck, you won't actually have to appear in person in all of them. They certainly can't yank you out of yours just to answer two questions in some other jig's trial. It rushes you right now, but then your defense is simple anyway."
"It is?"
"In principle. Were you a conspirator, intending to commit a mutiny? No. Were you a traitor in the pay of a foreign power? No. Simple. I expect they'll ask all the awkward questions they can think of, just so it looks good, and in case the original investigators forgot to check. But it's clear to me, and should be clear to them, that you were an ordinary junior officer who reacted to a developing situation. Luckily, in the best interests of both Fleet and the Familius Regnant. The only problem I see..."
"Yes?"
"Well, it's going to be difficult to present you as the ordinary junior officer, even though your fitness reports support that, putting you right square in the middle of your class, when you became the very unordinary youngest ever captain to blow away a Benignity heavy cruiser. They're going to want to know why you were hiding that kind of ability, how you hid that kind of ability. Why were you denying Fleet the benefit of your talent?"
"And that's what Admiral Serrano said."
"And what did you say?"
"I couldn't answer. I don't know. I didn't know I could do it until I did it. And I still find it hard to believe."
"Such modesty. I'm your defense counsel. And more than that, I'm an attorney with many years of experience. I was in civil practice and Fleet Reserves before I went full-time into Fleet. You may be able to fool yourself, young woman, but you don't fool me. You did what you did because you are unusually capable. Some of that capability showed up on the screening exams you took to get into Fleet in the first place, or had you forgotten your scores?"
She had. She had dismissed them as a fluke when her grades in the Fleet prep school came out only slightly above average.
"I'm now convinced that you were not hiding your talents for any obvious reason, such as being a Benignity agent, but you were hiding them. You avoided command track like a patchcock beach patrol. I pulled your file from prep school and talked to your instructors in the academy, too. They're all kicking themselves for not noticing and nurturing such an obvious talent for command."
"But I made mistakes. I was lucky. I had outstanding crew members who did most of it."
"It won't do. For your own good, Lieutenant Sweezer."
He had not called her that from the first day. She stiffened.
"For your own good, you must face what you are. You must admit how much of what happened was your doing. Your decisions. Good ones. Your ability to take charge, to get that performance from those you commanded. It was no accident. Whether the court dwells on this or not, you must. If you truly did not know what you were capable of, if you didn't know you were hiding your abilities, then you must figure out why. Otherwise, the rest of your life will be one mess after another."
As if she had spoken, his finger came up and leveled at her.
"And no, you cannot go back to being just another ordinary junior officer. Not after this. Whatever the court decides, reality has already decided. You are special. People will expect more. And you'd better learn to handle that."
Esme struggled to keep calm. One corner of her mind wondered why it was so hard to believe she was talented. Most of it concentrated on the need for control. The board, technically considered an administrative and not a judicial procedure, had attracted no media attention. But the multiple courts-martial of junior officers involved in a mutiny, and then in the successful defense of Xavier, was too juicy to miss. Fleet kept the defendants isolated as long as it could, but Chapin warned Esme that politics demanded the courts be open to selected media coverage.
"Usually no one much cares about courts-martial, but this case, or rather all your cases, are unique in Familius history. We've had to court-martial groups of officers before, the Tranvis Revolt, for instance, but we've never had to court-martial a group that had done something good. That has the newshounds baying for blood. And in a situation this complex, someone's going to bleed. And I don't want you sitting over the screens keeping track of the media. It'll only tie you in knots. But you needed to know before you went in that there will be media there, and they'll try to get statements from you between sessions, even though they've been told you're forbidden to give them. Just don't say anything, anything at all, while you're going from the courtrooms to the rooms where you'll be sequestered between sessions. I don't have to tell you to keep a composed face. You always do.
There she is!
Despite the warning, the mass of video and audio pickups, the competing voices of the media interviewers were like a blow to the face on her first trip between the defendant's suite and the courtroom.
Lieutenant Suiza! What do your family think about you being court-martialed?
Esme didn't want to think about that. Mindful of the publicity problem, she had sent only the briefest message to them and asked them not to reply. She didn't trust even Fleet Ansibles to keep such messages secure under the pressure of every news service in the Familius. She could feel her face settling into a stony mask, but behind that mask, she felt helpless, terrified. Inside the courtroom, Esme faced another bank of media pickups. Even as she followed the ritual of the court, she could not fail to be aware that every word, every fleeting expression, would be broadcast across the worlds for all to see. Chapin waited at the defense table.
Relax, Lieutenant. You look as if you were about to try the court, and not the other way around.
All the cases were linked by the need for officers to testify about each other's behavior, because of the need to determine whether the mutiny resulted from a conspiracy. But Esme, as the senior surviving officer, had been nominally charged with additional violations of the code. Chapin had emphasized that the charges were required, that he expected a fairly quick dismissal of most of them, given that no evidence supported them. But as far as Esme knew, none of the subordinates not in the pay of the Compassionate Hand had suspected Hearn or the others. She certainly hadn't. Hearn had seemed a bit slapdash in some ways, but she was rumored to be brilliant in combat, and rumor also linked a mild disregard for unnecessary regulations with superior combat ability. Now she found herself retelling the story of her assignment to Despite all over again. Her duties, her usual routine during time off duty, her responsibilities to officers, even more junior, her evaluation of her peers.
And you had suspected nothing about Captain Hearn, Major Casordi, Major Steck, or Lieutenant Arvad?
No, sir.
Esme had said this before, about each one separately.
And to your knowledge, no one else suspected that they were in the pay of the Benignity?
No, sir.
Did you have a particular relationship with Dorvir?
The idea was so ludicrous that Esme nearly lost control of her expression.
Dorvir, sir? No, sir.
In the lengthening silence, Esme was tempted to explain Dovir's preferences in particular companions, and decided better not.
And you never heard of anything of a plot to mutiny against Captain Hearn?
No, sir.
No grumbling of any sort from officer or enlisted?
Sir, of course I heard people grumble. They do. But not more than on any other ship.
And you have so much experience on so many ships.
Chapin stood up.
Objection?
Sustained. You are aware of the standards, Thedron.
Sir.
The chair peered at Esme.
Please discuss the nature of the grumbling, Lieutenant Suiza. This court is not sure that an inexperienced officer is fully aware of the amount of grumbling that is normal.
Yes, sir. When Despite was in the yards before I joined her, the recreation area had been cut by about 30% to allow retrofitting of the enhanced charge beam generator on the port side. That meant losing 15 of the exercise machines. It would have been 19, but Captain Hearn approved a tighter spacing. However, this meant shortening the exercise periods, and some crew could not get their required exercise without getting up on their downshift. Some complained that Hearn could have relaxed the exercise requirements or installed the other machines elsewhere.
What else?
Well, there was apparently a sneak thief pilfering from enlisted lockers. That caused a lot of annoyance because it should have been easy enough to catch, but the scanners never caught anything.
They'd been tampered with?
Chief Bascom assumed so, but couldn't prove it. It went on for perhaps 20 or 30 days, and it never happened again. The items taken were rarely of great monetary value, but always personal treasures.
Should she mention that they'd been found after the battle, in that cleanup phase, in the locker of someone killed? Yes, she had been taught that withholding information was the same as lying.
We found the things after the battle. But the person whose locker they were in had died in the original fight.
The mutiny, you mean?
Yes, sir. Under the circumstances, we just gave the stuff back to the owners. The surviving ones, that is.
Mm-hmm.
The trial went on, hour after tedious hour. Most of the time, the questions made sense, examining what she had known, what she had witnessed, what she had done. Other times, the court seemed determined to follow some useless thread of inquiry into a thicket where they would lodge until one of them kicked free and returned to the main issues. One of the side issues turned nasty. The hectoring Thedrin continued to ask his questions as if he was sure she was guilty of something dire.
Isn't it true, Lieutenant Sweeza, that you were charged with ensuring that the ensigns carried out their duties and put in the required hours of study?
Sir, that duty rotated among the four senior lieutenants junior grade, under the supervision of Lieutenant Hanguard. I was assigned that duty for the first 30 days after Despite left Sector HQ. Then it devolved onto the next senior, Lieutenant Junior Grade Pelisandra, for 30 days, and so on.
But as the senior, you were ultimately responsible.
No, sir. Lieutenant Hanguard made it clear that he wished the jig... Sorry.
Never mind. We do know what the word means.
Well, then, Lieutenant Hanguard wanted the jig in charge of the ensigns to report directly to him. He said we each needed to feel the responsibility alone for a short time.
And you were not aware that Ensign Arpan was engaged in illegal diversion of military equipment?
What? Ensign Arpan? But he's...
Ensign Arpan has been convicted of diversion and illegal sale of military goods to unlicensed buyers. In this case, his father's shipping company.
It's hard to believe.
On second thought, Esme could believe it, but still, why hadn't she noticed? How had someone else found out?
You haven't answered the question. Were you or were you not aware that Ensign Arpan had illegally diverted military equipment?
No, sir. I was not aware of that.
Very well. Now, about the mutiny itself.
Esme wondered why they bothered to ask questions which the surveillance cubes had already answered. Hearn had attempted to destroy all the records of her conversation with Serrano, but the mutiny erupted before she could. So the court had seen the playbacks from several angles. For Serrano had, of course, recorded Hearn's transmissions, and the transmissions agreed. What seemed to worry the court most was the possibility that the junior officers had been plotting even before Hearn defied Serrano. Esme repeated her earlier statements, and they picked them apart. How was it possible that she had not known Hearn was a traitor before? How was it possible that she had been party to a successful mutiny if she had not been involved in some plan with the other mutineers ahead of time? Was it really that easy to produce a spontaneous mutiny? By the end of the second day, Esme wanted to bang heads. She found it hard to believe that a whole row of senior officers were so incapable of recognizing what lay in front of them, so insistent on finding something other than the plain, obvious truth. Hearn had been a traitor, along with a few others of the officers and some of the enlisted. No one had noticed because, up until the moment she defied Serrano, her actions had not been suspicious.
You never had any suspicion that she was using illicit pharmaceuticals?
No, sir.
Esme had said that three times before. Captain Hearn had never appeared under the influence. Not that Esme would have been able to recognize subtle effects of drugs, even if she'd seen that much of Hearn. Esme had no way to know what she was taking, nor had she investigated Hearn's cabin after the mutiny to find out. She had had a battle to fight. More questions followed on Hearn's motivation. Major Chapin cut those off repeatedly. Esme was glad to sit and let him handle it. She felt stale and grumpy as well as tired. Of course she didn't know why Hearn might have turned traitor. Of course she didn't know if Hearn had been in debt, had had political connections to a foreign government, had harbored some grievance against Fleet. How could she? Her own motivations came into question. Esme answered as calmly as she could. She had harbored no grievance against Captain Hearn, who had spoken to her only a few times. When Hearn's private log came into evidence, she found that Hearn had described Lieutenant Junior Grade Sweeza as competent but colorless, causes no trouble, but lacks initiative.
Do you feel you lack initiative?
Esme considered this. Were they hoping she'd say yes or no? What hook did they plan to hang her on?
Sir, I'm sure Captain Hearn had reason to think that. It is my habit to be cautious, to be sure I understand the situation fully before stating an opinion. I was, therefore, not the first to offer solutions or suggestions when the captain posed a problem.
You didn't resent her opinion?
No, I thought she was right.
And you were satisfied with that?
Sir, I was not satisfied with myself, but the captain's opinion seemed fair.
I notice you use the past tense. Do you still feel the captain's evaluation of you was accurate?
Objection. Lieutenant Sweeze's present self-evaluation and its comparison to Captain Hearn's prior evaluation is not an issue.
At last it wound down. All the evidence given, all the questions asked and asked again, all the arguments made by opposing counsel. Esme waited while the officers conferred. In the reverse of the board procedures, she stayed in the courtroom while the members withdrew.
Take a long breath. You're looking pale again. But you did very well.
It seems so complicated.
Well, if they let it look as simple as it is, they'd have no good reason for a trial, except that it's the regulations. With all the media coverage, they don't want to make it look easy. They want it to look as if they were thorough and demanding.
Can you tell
how it will come out? If they don't acquit you of all charges, I'll be very surprised. They have the board report. They know you've been chewed on about mistakes. And if they don't acquit, we'll appeal. That'll be easier, actually, out from under the media's many eyes. Besides, they found themselves a bad apple to squash. That young Arpan fellow.
The officers returned, and Esme stood, heart beating so that she could scarcely breathe.
Lieutenant Junior Grade Esme Sweezer, it is the decision of this court that you are innocent of all charges made against you. This court has voted unanimously for acquittal. Congratulations, Lieutenant.
Thank you, sir.
Esme managed to stay on her feet during the final ceremonies, which again included greeting each officer on the court and the prosecuting counsel, who, now that he wasn't badgering her with questions, seemed friendly and harmless.
I knew we didn't have a chance. It was obvious from the evidence, really, but we had to go through with it. Unless you'd come in here blind drunk and assaulted an admiral, you were safe enough.
I didn't feel safe.
Then I did my job, Lieutenant. That's what I'm supposed to do, scare the defendant into admitting every scrap of guilt. You just didn't happen to have any. Fred, why do you always get the easy ones? The last fellow I had to defend was a mean-minded SOB who'd been blackmailing recruits.
I'm rewarded for my virtues.
Esme didn't feel like joining in their laughter. She felt like finding a quiet place to sleep for a week.
What do you do now, Lieutenant?
Take some leave. They said it'd be a while before they had a new assignment for me, and I could have 30 days home leave plus travel. I haven't been home since I left.
Esme wasn't that anxious to go home, but she knew no other way to escape the media attention. Esme thought she had outdistanced the last of the news hounds two stops before her homeworld, Altiplano. When she came out of the arrival lounge into the main concourse, the bright lights blinded her for a moment. They had figured out where she was going, of course. She set her jaw and kept going. They could have all they liked of her walking from one side of the station to another. They might even get someone on the down shuttle, but once she hit the dirt, they would find themselves blocked. That would be one good to come out of this misconceived homecoming.
Lieutenant Sweeza!
It took a long moment, several strides, for her to realize that one of the yells wasn't a news hound's demand for a comment, but her Uncle Bertol. She looked around.
Oh, no.
He wore his dress uniform, and Esme thought ahead to the reaction of her fleet acquaintances when they saw the news clips of this. When he caught her eye, he quit waving and pulled himself rigid. Esme stopped short, bracing against the expected crunch from behind, and saluted. When her father had sent word that he could not meet her at the station, she'd assumed that meant no one would. She hadn't expected Bertol. Now he opened a path between them with a glance that sent the news hounds scurrying out of the way.
Good to see you, Esmea.
And you, sir.
God's teeth, Esmea. I'm not a sir to you.
But the twinkle in his eye approved of her formality. The stars on his shoulders glittered as the cameras shifted for better angles, their spotlights crisscrossing. Esme had told Fleet that her father was one of four regional commanders. She had not reminded them what must be in her file, that her uncles Bertol and Gerard were two of the others.
I guess you didn't starve in Fleet after all. You know, Grandmother is still convinced you can find nothing legal to eat.
Esme found herself grinning, even as she wished he hadn't brought that up. Grandmother was his grandmother, not hers. Well over 100, and an influence as potent in her way as Papa Stefan in his. She turned, hoping to convince Bertolt not to grandstand for the cameras.
I'm fine.
Bertolt touched her shoulder gently.
More than fine, Esmea. You give us pride. We are more than glad to have you home.
Now he turned. His aides, she noticed now, had been scattered in the crowd and now came together at his back. The glaring lights receded behind them.
When we get down, we will celebrate.
Esme's heart sank. What she really wanted was a quiet drive out to the Estancia and a room with windows open to the Rose Garden and a full night's sleep, a night that fit her body's rhythms. Bertolt ushered her into the waiting shuttle and into the rear compartment, which his aides closed off as they came through.
We can't waste this.
What's going on?
Tension curdled her stomach. She did not really want to know.
What's going on? You'll be fully briefed later. We didn't reserve a full shuttle. We thought it would be too obvious, natural enough to have a private compartment. And there's no way out of the welcoming celebration, though I'm sure you're ready for a vacation at home, eh?
Esme nodded. She glanced around at Bertolt's aides. The militia ranks were not those of fleet, exactly. The insignia, except for stars marking flag rank, were completely different. It came back to her in a rush. Infantry, armor, air, navy. What her fleet called, somewhat disparagingly, wet fleet. All four branches here, all of them older than she was. The one wearing armor tags had an ear wire, and now he turned to Bertolt.
General Suiza says it's all ready, sir.
Your father. He's in charge down there, for reasons that will become clear later. In the meantime, there'll be a formal ceremony at the shuttleport, blessedly brief, if you know your father. And then a parade into town, and a formal presentation at the palace.
Presentation?
Ah, you see, Esme, when it was your action that saved an entire planet, and then you don't even get a token of recognition from your fleet.
Dear God.
Esme scrambled through all the possible explanations she could make, that he would not understand, and realized it was no use. They had decided that her fleet had not sufficiently honored her, and it would do no good to point out that her acquittal was itself acknowledgement and reward. Besides, she knew that someone had put in a recommendation for a medal, which made her skin itch to think of it. She wished they'd just forget it, but this...
And it's not like you're just any shaggy pony out of the back lots. You're a Suiza. They're treating you...
Very well, Uncle Bertolt.
She was hoping to stop him if she couldn't stop the ceremony.
No, I don't think so. Nor does the long table. They voted to give you the Star Mount.
No.
Yes.
And a title of your own, to be converted if you marry an Altiplano.
Dear God.
She didn't deserve this. It was ridiculous. It would cause immense trouble either way. No matter that Fleet would not realize it had been intended as a rebuke, they would find it awkward, and that made her awkward.
Not much of a steading with it. In fact, your father said he'd provide that. It's that little valley where you used to hide out.
Despite herself, Esme felt a stab of pleasure at the memory of that little mountain valley, with its facing slopes of poplar and pine, its grassy meadows and clear stream. She had claimed it years before in her mind, but had never thought it would be hers. If it could be, she remembered some RSS regulations she was afraid might interfere.
Don't worry. It's under the limit. Your father ran a new survey and chopped it short at the upper end. It's under the glacier there. Anyway, if you need to refresh yourself on the protocol of the award ceremony...
She did, of course. The data cube the major with the armor insignia handed her contained not only the ceremony, but a briefing on recent political developments and her family's position on all of them. The Minerals Development Commission was still squabbling with the Marine Biological Commission over control of benthic development. That quarrel would have been unimportant on many worlds, but on Altiplano, the Minerals Development Commission represented the secularists, while Old Believers and the Lifehearts controlled the Marine Biological Commission, which meant that an argument over exactly when a benthic vent community was dead and could be mined might erupt in religious riots around the entire planet.
Sani is involved with the Lifehearts again.
Esme remembered vividly the moment when her romantic feelings about the night sky became utter certainty that she would have to leave her home forever. Her Aunt Sani, Sanibel Aresha Livon Suiza, and her Uncle Bertol screaming at each other across the big dining room at the Estancia. Sani, a lifeheart, as rigid in her piety as any old believer. Esme found the lifeheart philosophy attractive, but Sani in a rage terrified her. Yet it was Bertol who had thrown the priceless chocolate pot, shattering its painted water lilies and swans, scarring the wide polished table. Her own father had walked in on the end of that, with Sani scrabbling on the floor for shards and Bertol still yelling. And Papa Stefan, 2 paces behind him, had shamed them both into apologies and handshakings. Esme hadn't believed it. Whatever was wrong between Sani and Bertol stayed wrong, and was still wrong. And here she was, back in the middle of it.
It's not my problem now. I'm only here for a short leave.
She likes you. She says you're the only sane member of your generation, and now you're a hero.
I'm not. All I did...
Esme, this is family. You don't have to pretend. All you did, you babykin, was survive a mutiny, come out on top, and then defeat a warship twice your size.
It didn't know I was there until too late.
So you were smarter than its captain. Hero, Esme. Get used to it. You're carrying our flag out there, Esme, and you're doing very well.
She was not carrying their flag, but her own. They would not understand that, even if she dared say it to them. And Bertol sounded too much like Major Chapin, too much like Admiral Serrano. She had been a hero by accident. Why wasn't it as obvious to the others as it was to her?
And Sani's proud of you. She wants to talk to you, ask you all about Fleet, about your life. If you're meeting anyone eligible, if I know Sani.
She had left for a good reason. She should have stayed away. Yet at the thought of the whole family for once approving, for once seeing her as an asset rather than a very chancy proposition, her heart beat faster.
The Star Mount.
She remembered the first soldier she'd seen awarded the Star Mount, a lean red-haired fellow who walked lopsided. As a little girl, she had stared and stared at the medal on its blue and silver ribbon that dangled around his neck until a disapproving grown-up made her apologize and then quit following him. No one from Altiplano could be indifferent to the Star Mount, and she didn't have to tell Fleet how she felt. At the shuttle field, the only media wore the green and scarlet uniforms of the Altiplano Central News Agency. No one tried to speak to her. No one tried to crowd close. She knew that her walk from the shuttle through the terminal to the waiting car would be only one clip in the finished story, narrated by a senior analyst. No one would try to interview her. Here, that was considered rude and disrespectful. Her father, backed by a wedge of other officers, gave her the same formal salute Bertol had. She returned it, and he gave her the semi-formal hug and kisses, not fatherly, but from commander to junior about to be honored. She was introduced to his senior aide and to the next senior. She was led through a corridor where a solid block of militia provided complete privacy. In their terms, which meant from civilian eyes, for her few moments in the ladies' retiring room. There, she found 2 tiring maids ready to apply fresh makeup and attempt to do something about her flyaway hair. That ended in a spritz of scented stuff, which would leave her scalp itchy for 2 days. But this once, she didn't mind. In moments, they had whisked off her RSS uniform jacket, pressed it, and after a look at the shirt beneath, insisted on replacing it with a clean one from her luggage. Refreshed, and to her surprise, cheered by these ministrations, Esme came back out to the corridor.
It's only 1 cloud, and it might not rain.
It's only 1 bullet, and it might miss. I'm not taking the chance. When her hair gets wet... Oh, there you are, Esmea. There's a line of storms moving into the city. We're going to go by car.
It's not nearly as impressive. And it's not as if you expected her to do any real riding.
Esme had assumed by car. She'd forgotten that on Altiplano, all ceremony involved horses. She thanked some unknown deity for the gift of a possible rainstorm and her father's distaste for the frizzy mess her hair became if it got damp. At least no one from Fleet was here to make a joke about a backwoods military that still used horses. Of course, the parade still had horses, even though she was in a car. From the protection of the car, she watched the perfectly drilled cavalry swing into position before and behind, the horses moving in unison, their glossy haunches bunching and relaxing. The riders, their backs upright, hands quiet, faces set in a neutral expression that would not vary if a horse stood up on its hind legs. Not that one of those well-trained animals would. Beyond the horses, a crowd on the sidewalks, faces peering from the windows of the taller buildings. Some of them waved the gold and red Altiplano colors. She had not been home for just over 10 standard years. She had left as a gawky teenager, who in memory seemed the very model of adolescent incapacity. Nothing had fit, not her body, nor her mind, nor her emotions. From not fitting at home to not fitting in the Fleet Prep School had been a tiny, natural transition. By the time she had graduated from the academy, she had expected to be the odd one out, the one whose reactions were not natural. She had not realized how much those feelings had been due to age, and then the real displacement of leaving her home world before her adult identity had solidified. Now, in the light of Altiplano's sun, with her body held by Altiplano's gravity, she began to relax, feeling at home in a way she had not since she was a little girl. The colors were right in a way they had not been for years. Her very bones knew that this gravity, not one standard G, was the right gravity. When she stepped out of the car and walked up the red stone steps of the palace, her feet found the right intervals without effort. These steps were the right height, the right depth. This stone felt solid enough. This doorway welcomed. This air smelled right and felt right all the way down to the bottom of her lungs. She looked around at the people now crowding into the hall around her. Humans were humans, but the shapes of humans varied with their genome and the worlds they lived on. Here, the bone structure looked familiar. These were the faces she had known all her life. Prominent cheekbones and brows, long jutting chins, eyes set deeply under thick eyebrows. These long arms and legs, big bony hands and feet, boxy joints. These were her people, her look. Here she fit in, at least physically.
Esmea, Zord Zemzalas.
Esme turned. Her ears had already adapted to the Altiplano dialect, even in her family's less obvious form, and she had no trouble understanding the welcome she'd just been given. She didn't immediately recognize the wizened old man in front of her, stiffly upright and wearing the brilliant braid of a former senior NCO. Retired Master Sergeant Sebastian Coron had been part of her life as far back in childhood as she could remember, always crisp and correct, but with a twinkle for his commander's elder daughter. She thanked him for his congratulations in the formal phrases that brought a broader grin to his face.
And your family? Your body sons and heart daughters? And don't I remember that you have grandlings now?
Before he could answer, her father had extended his own hand to Coron.
You can come visit later. We need to get her upstairs.
Coron nodded, gave Esme a stiff, short bow, and stepped back as her father led her away.
I hope you don't mind. He's so proud of you, you'd think he was your father. He wanted to come.
Of course I don't mind.
And he wants to hear about it direct from you, at least some of it.
That's fine.
Esme would rather tell old Coron than any of the fresh-faced young militia officers now surrounding them. Coron had taught her more of the basics than her father probably knew. She had pored over the handbooks on small unit tactics under his watchful eye all one summer down in Varsimla.
He does get a bit carried away, but he saved my skin often enough.
Her father looked ahead to the upper hall, where a cluster of men in formal dress waited in a semicircle.
Ah, there we are, the long table advisors. Did you have time in the car?
She had not, but that's what the earplugs were for. Most of them were men she had met before, in the way that the children of a household meet distinguished guests. The current long table host, Audrey Castendas Garland, had once slipped coming into their dining room and knocked over the little table with the hot towels on it. Her great-grandmother had scolded her for staring.
Esme, Lieutenant Suiza, it is an honor.
Esme allowed herself an interior smile. Altiplano lacked the right honorific for someone like her. Female, a military officer, a hero. She felt conflicting impulses to help him out and to let him stew in his problem. They, after all, had wanted to make her a hero.
My dear, I'm sorry, but I keep remembering the sweet child you were. It's hard to grasp what you've become.
Esme could cheerfully have slapped him. She had been a sulky, awkward teenager, the successor to an awkward child. Not sweet, but difficult and strange. And what she was now should be simple enough to grasp. A junior officer of the regular space service.
I think it's clear enough.
She didn't recognize the other man. Opposition leader, her earplug said. Orias Leandros. He smiled at her, but the smile was intended for the host. He would make political profit of her, he thought. Esme didn't like either of them, but she knew where her family duty lay.
Host Garland, you can be no more amazed at my present predicament than I am. My father tells me you plan an award, but you must realize you do me too much honor.
Garland shot the briefest glare at his rival.
Not at all. It's obvious that your family inheritance of military ability continues down the generations. No doubt your sons.
He'd found himself trapped again in the assumptions of Altiplano and the usual phrases. What would have been a fine compliment to a man sounded almost indecent applied to a woman.
It has been so long. Perhaps you would introduce me to the other advisors?
Of course.
How had Garland ever been elected host when he was still as clumsy in word and deed as ever? But he got through the introductions well enough, and Esme managed to smile with the right intensity at all the right people. The awards ceremony itself felt odd, because Esme could not feel anything at all. She was too aware of the faint murmur of the earplug, coaching her through the required lines, of the expressions on the faces around her. The embarrassment she'd felt when first told of the award could not penetrate the concentration needed to do it right. The star mount itself, a disc with the blue and black enamel representing a mountain against the sky, the little diamond glittering at the peak, aroused neither pride nor guilt. She bent her head to let the host put the wide blue and gray ribbon around her neck. The medal felt lighter than she'd expected. Then it was only a matter of standing in the line, saying the ritual greetings and thanks to those who filed past her until the last of the line, a white-haired old lady related to Esme's grandmother in some complicated way, had passed from her father to her and from her to the host. She had a few minutes to sip the tangy fruit juice and taste the pastries. Then her father hurried her into the car again for the trip home. She would like to have stayed longer. She was still hungry, and some of the faces that had blurred past had been friends once. She would have liked a chance to shop in town to get herself some new clothes. But she had no more to say about it than when she'd been a schoolgirl. The general said it was time to leave, and they left. She tried not to resent it.
Papa Stefan. He didn't feel well enough to come in, but he had planned a family reception.
Esme could not imagine Papa Stefan anything but well. He had been white-haired even in her childhood, but vigorous, riding and working alongside his sons and grandchildren. Things had changed then. She had known they would, eventually, but it was hard to feel the same gravity, breathe the same air, recognize the same smells, and think of change. The buildings they drove past, the substantial stone blocks that housed stores and banks and offices, were the same she had always known. Outside the city, the grasslands surged up to the mountains, as always. Esme looked out the window, relaxing into that familiar view. The black teeth, between which dark spires lay the legendary lair of the Great Worm. As a child, she'd believed the dragon stories were about her own world. She had believed the lair was stuffed with dragon's treasure. She had been bitterly disappointed to find out that the Great Worm was the code name of the rebel alliance that had, so legend went, massacred the original owner of Altiplano and all his family. A school field trip to the lair showed it to be a perfectly ordinary bunker built into the cliff on one side of a canyon. South of the Black Teeth were the other peaks of the Romilo Escarpment, lesser only by contrast to the teeth. Esme squinted across the kilometers of shimmering light, looking for the gap in the line, the grassy embayment of her family's estancia. There. The trees marked it out, the long lines of formal plantings along the road and the drives. The car slowed, pulling off the road.
I don't know if you still observe, but it's customary when someone returns from a long journey. And anyway, I'm going to light a candle.
Esme felt the heat rise to her face. Bad enough to forget, but to have her father suspect she'd forgotten was worse.
I too.
Esme clambered out of the car, stiff and feeling even more awkward than stiffness would explain. She hadn't thought of the ceremony since she'd left home. She wasn't sure she remembered the words. The shrine, built into the Estancia gate wall, had a row of fresh flower wreaths laid out below the niche. She could smell the faint sweet scent of the wreaths and the stronger aroma of the great trees that loomed above. Even as an imaginative child, Esme had never been able to see any meaning in the blurred shape of the statue in the niche. Now she saw with fresh eyes, and it still looked like a grayish, shiny, melted blob, taller than it was wide. Around its base, the candle cups were clean as always, the little white candles in a box to one side. Her father took one, set it in the green glass cup, and lit it. Esme took another, lit it from her father's flame, and got it into a cup without burning her fingers. Her father said nothing, and neither did she. They stood side by side, watching the flames writhe in the breeze. Then he plucked a needle from one of the trees and laid it in the flame. Blue smoke swirled up. Esme remembered to stoop and find a pebble to lay in the wax of her candle. Back in the car, with the windows now open to the steady breeze, her father still said nothing. Esme leaned back, enjoying the many shades of green and gold. The drive, bordered with rows of narrow conifers, ran straight for a kilometer. On the right were the orchards, past blooming now. She could just see knots of green fruit on some limbs. On the far side, the first plums should be ripening. On the left, the family polo fields, mown in crisscross patterns. Someone was out there, stooping, stamping divots back in. Nearer the house, flower gardens burst into riotous color. The car swept around the front, into the wide, graveled space large enough to review a mounted troop. It had been used for that years back. A broad portico shaded by tangled vines thick as trees at the root. Two steps up to the wide double door. Home.
Not home now.
Nothing had changed, at least on the surface. Her room, with its narrow white bed, its shelves full of old books, its cube racks full of familiar cubes. Her old clothes had been removed, but by the time she came upstairs, someone had unpacked her luggage. She knew without asking what would be in each drawer. She undressed, hanging her uniform on the left end of the pole. It would be taken away and cleaned, returned to the right end of the pole. Presently, the right end of the pole had two outfits she did not own. Someone's suggestion of what to wear to the family dinner. She had to admit they looked more comfortable than anything she had bought off-planet. Down the familiar hall to the big square bathroom, with its two shower stalls and its vast tub. After shipboard accommodations, it seemed impossibly large. But just this once, she slid the door marker to long bath and grinned to herself. She did like long, hot baths. When she came downstairs, in the long, cream-colored tunic over soft, loose brown slacks, her father and stepmother were waiting. Her stepmother, born elegant, gave an approving nod, which for some reason made Esme furious. No doubt she had chosen that tunic, had put it in Esme's closet. For a moment, Esme thought of ripping it off and throwing it. But RSS officers did not behave like that. And her half-brothers were watching, and others coming into the hall. She smiled at her stepmother and shook the offered hand.
Welcome home, Esmea. I hope you will like dinner.
Of course she will.
Dinner was in the informal dining hall, its wide windows opening on a tiled courtyard with a pool and fountain. She started toward her old place out of habit, but someone sat there already, a cousin, no doubt, and her father was leading her up the table to sit at Papa Stefan's left hand. Great-grandmother was not at the table. She would be waiting to receive Esme afterwards, in her own parlor.
Here she is, at last.
Papa Stefan had aged. He was thinner, the skin looser over his bones. But his eyes were still sharp. His mouth, even as he smiled at her, still firm.
Your father tells me you remember the proper offering for return. Do you also remember the proper blessing of food?
Esme blinked. Once away from Altiplano, she had shed all concern about clean and unclean foods, blessings and cursings, as happily as she'd shed the traditional undergarments considered appropriate for a virtuous daughter. She had not expected this honor. As much test as honor, as everyone knew. Ordinarily, only sons and sons of sons asked blessings on the food at dinner. Daughters and daughters of daughters asked the morning grace at the breaking of the night's fast. And at the noon meal, everyone held silence. She looked down the table to see what was on the great platters. It made a difference. And was even more surprised to see the five platters that meant a whole calf had been butchered in her honor. She had never heard of a woman speaking at such a time, but she knew the words.
Back from the waist.
She continued through the hole, stumbling only momentarily over the nested clauses where the prayer expected a male speaker, and she had either to speak of herself in the masculine or change the words.
From father to son, it came to me, and so I send it on.
Esme had not thought about her own culture in any detailed way after the first year or so in the Fleet prep schools. She had not noticed how confining the language really was. Fleet had shocked her at first, with its assumption of easy relationships between the sexes, with sir used for both men and women. In Fleet, the important terms for parents distinguished between gene parents and life parents, not between mothers and fathers. On Altiplano, they had no word for parents, and while they knew of modern methods of reproduction, very few would ever use them. She finished the blessing, still thinking of the differences. Esme glanced at Papa Stefan. His eyes twinkled.
You didn't forget. You always had a good memory, Esme.
He nodded. The servants stepped forward. The great platters were shifted to the sideboards for carving, while bowls of soup were offered. Fleet food had been good enough, but this was the food of her childhood. The thick blue bowl with the creamy corn soup, garnished with green and red. Esme's stomach rumbled at the familiar aroma. The spoon she lifted had her family's crest on it. It fit her fingers as if it had grown there. The first salad followed the corn soup, and by then the meat had been sliced and layered on blue platters swirled with white. Esme accepted three slices, a mound of the little yellow potatoes that were a family specialty, a scoopful of carrots. It was worth the long wait to have food like this. Right now, all she wanted was the food she had not let herself realize she missed. Puffy rolls that could have floated up into the sky as clouds, butter molded into the shapes of heraldic beasts. She remembered those molds, hanging in a row in the kitchen. She remembered the rolls, too. No use letting them get cold when they were dry and tasteless. They deserved to be soaked in new butter or drenched in honey. When she came up for air, no one seemed to be paying attention to her anyway. They had finished eating. Servants were taking their plates away.
It's a matter of pride. Esme would not fail in anything that touched the family honor.
Esme blinked. Papa Stefan's notion of family honor had wildernesses no one had ever explored fully. She hoped he wasn't hatching up one of his plots with her assigned the role of heroine. Her cousin, Lucy, the age Esme had been when she left, looked much as Esme remembered herself. Tall, gangling, soft brown hair pulled back severely, with escaping wisps that ruined the intended effect. Clothes that were obviously intended for a special occasion, but looked rumpled and dowdy instead. Lucy looked up, met Esme's eyes, and flushed. That made her look sulky as well as unkempt.
Hello, Lucy.
Esme had already greeted Papa Stefan and the elders. The cousins were far down the list of obligatory greetings. She wanted to say something helpful, but after 10 years, she had no idea what Lucy's enthusiasms were, and a very clear memory of how embarrassing it was when elders assumed you still liked the dolls you'd played with at 5 or 7. Papa Stefan grinned at her and patted Lucy's arm.
Esmea, you will not know that Lucy is the best polo player in her class.
Oh, I am not that good.
You probably are. I'm sure you're better than I am.
Esme had never seen the point of milling about chasing a ball on horseback. A horse was mobility, a way to get off by herself into places vehicles couldn't go, faster than anyone could follow on foot.
Are you playing on the school team or the family team?
Both. We are looking for championships this year.
If we are lucky. And speaking of that, I want to ask about that mare Olin showed me.
Oh, ask Esme. Her father bought a string for her to put out on the grant, and that mare was one of them.
A flash of anger from Lucy's eyes. Esme was startled, both by the gift of horses and her cousin's unexpected reaction.
I didn't know about that. He hadn't mentioned anything. If there's one you wanted in particular, Lucy, I'm sure.
Lucy stood up.
Never mind. I wouldn't want to deprive the returning hero of her loot.
Lucy!
Papa Stefan glared, but Lucy was already out the door. She didn't reappear that evening. No one commented, but they were already drifting from the table. Esme remembered from her own adolescence that such a thing would not be spoken of in company. She did not envy Lucy the rough side of Sonny's tongue that would no doubt work her over in private very shortly. After dinner, Esme went to the private apartment where her great-grandmother waited. 10 years ago, the old lady had still lived apart, refusing to inhabit the main house because of some quarrel that no one would explain. Esme had tried to wheedle it out of her, unsuccessfully. She had not been the kind of great-grandmother who encouraged the sharing of secrets. Esme had been scared of her, of the sharp glance that could silence even Papa Stefan. 10 years had thinned the silver hair and dimmed the once bright eyes.
Welcome, Esmea. Are you well?
Yes, of course.
And they feed you decently?
Yes, but I was glad to taste our food again.
Of course. The stomach cannot be easy when the heart is uncertain.
Great-grandmother belonged to the last generation which adhered almost universally to the old prohibitions and requirements. Immigrants and trade, the usual means of fraying the edges of cultures, had brought changes that seemed great to her, though to Esme hardly significant compared to Altiplano's difference from the cosmopolitan casualness of Fleet.
I do not approve of your gallivanting around the galaxy, but you have brought us honor, and for that I am pleased.
Thank you.
Considering your disadvantages, you have done very well.
Disadvantages? What disadvantages?
I suppose it means your father was right, though I am loath to agree, even now.
Esme had no idea what great-grandmother was talking about.
I hope you will choose to remain, Esme. Your father has chosen for you the reward of bloodstock and land. You would not be as a beggar among us.
That was a dig. She had complained, just before she left, that she had nothing of her own, that she might as well be a poor beggar living here on sufferance.
I had hoped you might forget those rash words. I was very young.
But not untruthful, Esmea. The young speak the truth they see, however limited it is. And you were always a truthful child. You saw no future here. You saw it among the stars. Now that you have seen them, I hope you can find one here.
I have been happy there.
You could be happy here. It is not the same. You are an adult and a hero.
This is my home, but I don't think I can stay here. Not always. Not forever.
Your father was an idiot. Now go away and let me rest. No, I'm not angry. I love you dearly, as I always did. And when you go, I will miss you extremely. Come back tomorrow.
Yes, great-grandmother.
Later that evening, in the great library, Esme found herself comfortably ensconced in a vast leather chair with her father, Bertol, and Papa Stefan. They started with the questions she'd expected about her experiences in Fleet. To her surprise, she found herself enjoying it. They asked intelligent questions, applied their own military experience to the answer. She found herself relaxing, talking about things she had never expected to discuss with her male relatives.
That reminds me, someone told me that Altiplano has a reputation for being ageist, opposed to rejuvenation. That's not so, is it?
Her father and uncle looked at each other.
Not exactly against rejuvenation, Esmea, but many people here see it as bringing more problems to us than it could solve.
I suppose you mean population growth.
Partly. Altiplano's primarily an agricultural economy, as you know. Not only is this world suited to it, but we have all those life hearts and old believers. We attract immigrants who want to live on the land. Rapid population growth, or slow growth, long continued, would start encroaching on the land. But consider what it means to a military organization for a start.
Your most experienced personnel wouldn't get too old for service. You, Uncle Bertol?
Generals are to a credit. But of course, the most experienced you have, the fellow who can always cobble up a repair for your land cruiser or your artillery, will stay useful and perhaps even pick up more expertise. Experience counts, and with rejuvenation, you can accumulate more experience to learn from. That's the positive. The negative?
Longer lives for the seniors mean fewer slots for juniors to be promoted into. It would slow down career advancement.
It would stop it in its tracks.
I don't see why.
Because it's repeatable now. The rejuvenated general, to start at the top, will be there forever. Oh, there'll be some slots for promotion. Someone will die of an accident or in a war, but that's not many. Your fleet will become the weapon of an expansionist familius regnant empire.
No.
It has to, Esme. If rejuvenation gets going...
It's already widespread, we know that. They've had the new procedure 40 years or more now, and they've tried it on a lot of people. Remember your biology classes, girl. If the population expands, it must find new resources or die. Changes in population are governed by birth rate and death rate. Lower the death rate, as rejuvenation does, and you've got an increase in population.
But the Familius isn't expansionist.
Huh. The Familius didn't announce a grand campaign, no. But if you look at the borders these last 30 years, a nibble here, a nibble there, the terraforming and colonization of planets, which had been written off as unsuitable, peaceful, cooperative annexation of half a dozen little systems.
They asked for fleet protection.
Esme's father gave Bertol a glance that said, "Be quiet," as clearly as words.
So they did. But our point is that if the population of Familius worlds continues to increase because the old are being rejuvenated, and if the population of the fleet continues to increase for the same reason, then this pressure can move them toward expanding.
I don't think they will.
Why do you think your captain went over to the Black Scratch?
I don't know. Money? Power?
Rejuvenation? A long life and prosperity? Because, you know, a long life is prosperity.
I don't see that.
A long, young life. You see, that's the other thing that bothers me about rejuvenation. Longevity rewards prudence above all. If you live long enough and are prudent, you will prosper. All you have to do is avoid risk.
So?
So, prudence is not high on the list of military virtues. It is one, sure enough, but... where are you going to get soldiers who will risk their lives if avoidance of risk can confer immortality? Not the immortality of the believers, who expect to get it after they die, but immortality in this life.
Rejuvenation may work in a civilian society, but we think it can cause nothing but trouble in the military. Even if you could retain all your best experienced men, you would soon be out of the routine of training recruits, and the population you served would be out of the routine of providing them. which means that a military organization with anything but mud between the ears is going to see that it must limit the use of rejuvenation, or plan on a constant expansion. And at some point, it's going to run into a culture of younglings, a culture which doesn't use rejuvenation and is bolder, more aggressive.
It sounds like the old argument between the religious and the non-religious. If immortality of the soul is real, then what matters most is the prudent life, to make sure the soul qualifies for immortality.
Yes, but all the religions we know of which offer that prize also define such prudence in more stringent terms. They require active virtues which discipline the believer and curtail his or her selfishness. Some even demand the opposite of prudence, recklessness of life in the service of their deity. This makes good soldiers. It's why religious wars are so much harder to end than others.
And here, you see rejuvenation rewarding, encouraging, merely practical prudence, pure selfishness?
Yes. There will no doubt be good people rejuvenated.
Esme noted the assumption that good people would not be selfish. It was a curious assumption for a man who was himself rich and powerful, but of course he didn't define himself as selfish. He had never had to be selfish, in his own terms, to have his least wish satisfied.
But even they will, over several rejuvenations, realize how much more good they can do alive, in control of their assets, than dead. It's easy to lie to yourself, to convince yourself that you can do more good with more power.
And that's not even considering the dependency created by reliance on rejuvenation. Unless you have control of the process, adulteration...
As happened recently.
I can see that.
Good. So when they offer you rejuvenation, Esmea, what will you do?
For that, Esme had no answer. She had never even considered the question before. Her father shifted the topic to a reprise of the ceremony, and soon she excused herself and went to bed. The next morning, waking in her own bed in her own room, with sunlight bright on the walls, she was surprised by a sense of peace. She had suffered enough bad dreams in this bed. She had been half afraid the nightmares would recur. Perhaps coming home had completed some sort of necessary ritual, and they were forever banished. With that thought, she hurried down to breakfast, where her stepmother offered the morning grace, and then out into the cool gold of a spring morning. She passed the kitchen gardens and the chicken runs, where every hen seemed to be clucking her readiness to lay eggs, and every rooster crowed defiance at the others. The great stables smelled, as always, of horses and oats and hay, pungencies that Esme found comforting after all these years. She walked down the stone-flagged aisle, the great arches opening to her left, into one of the exercise yards. On her right, rows of stalls with the dark, narrow heads of horses peering out. A groom came out of a tack room looking confused.
Yes, dama?
Good morning. We haven't met. I am Esme Suiza.
Oh, forgive me, dama. Of course, I have heard much about you. Welcome home.
Thank you. I was wondering, my cousin Lucy mentioned a mare she'd looked at. That Olin showed her?
Ah, the Vasexi daughter. Down here, dama, if you'll follow me. Excellent bloodlines, that one, and has done very well in training so far. That is why the general chose her for your foundation herd.
Outside the mare's stall, a twist of blue and silver. Esme looked down the row and saw more such twists. This was her herd, picked by her father, and although she could exchange them, it would shame him. But to make a gift of one mare to Lucy, that would be acceptable, she hoped.
Here, dama.
The mare had her rump to the door, but when the groom clucked, she swung round. Esme recognized the qualities for which her father had chosen the horse. The good legs and feet, the depth of heart girth, the strong back and hindquarters, the long, limber neck and well-bred head. Solid dark brown, just lighter than black. The groom reached for the halter that hung beside the stall.
You would like to see her move?
Yes, thank you.
The groom led the mare out of the stall, across the aisle, and out into the courtyard. There, in the open ring, the groom put the mare through her paces, which accorded with her confirmation. A long, low walk, a sweeping trot, and long, level canter. This was a horse to cover the ground mile after mile, and yet she would be handy as well. A good mare. If only Esme cared particularly.
I'm sorry I was rude. She's a lovely mare, and you deserve her.
Lucy's face was in the arch's shadow. Esme walked nearer. Lucy had been crying.
Not really. I'm sure you heard all about my regrettable attitude towards horses back when I left.
I inherited your trail horse.
Esme had not thought about old Red, had that been his name? In years.
Good.
You don't mind?
Why should I mind? I left home. I couldn't expect the horse to go unused.
They didn't let anyone ride him for a year.
So they thought I might flunk out and come back?
Oh, of course not. It's just...
Of course they did. But I didn't fail, and I didn't come back. I'm glad you got that horse. You seem to have inherited the family gift.
I can't believe you really haven't...
I can't believe anyone really wants to stay on one planet, even when it feels right.
Lucy flung out an arm.
But it's not crowded. There's so much space. You can ride for hours.
Esme felt the familiar tension in her shoulders. Yes, she could ride for hours and never come to a border she need worry about, but she could not eat a meal without wondering if some old family grievance was about to explode. She turned to Lucy, whose eyes kept following the mare.
Lucy, would you do me a favor?
I suppose.
Take the mare.
Esme almost laughed at the shock on Lucy's face.
Take the mare. You want her, I don't. I'll square it with Papa Stefano with Father.
I can't.
You can. If that's my mare, I can do what I want with her. And what I want to do is to give her away because I'm going back to Fleet. And that mare deserves an owner who will train her, ride her, breed her.
But your herd.
I don't need a herd. It's enough to know I have my little valley to come home to. What would I do with a herd?
You're serious.
Yes, I'm serious. She's yours. Play polo on her, race her, breed her, whatever. She's yours, not mine.
I don't understand you, but I do want her.
Of course you do.
Esme felt a century older at least. Embarrassment hit then. Had she seemed this young to Commander Serrano, to everyone who had a decade or more on her? Probably.
Listen, let's go for a ride. I'll need to get back in shape if I'm going to visit the valley.
Esme couldn't yet say my valley, even to Lucy.
You could ride her, if you wanted.
Heavens no. I need one of the school horses, something solid and dependable. I don't get any riding in Fleet.
Grooms tacked up the horses, and they rode out toward the front fields between the rows of fruit trees. Esme watched Lucy on the mare. Lucy rode as if her spine were rooted into the horse's spine, as if they were one being. Esme, on a stolid gelding with gray around its eyes and muzzle, felt her hip joints creaking as she trotted. As Lucy cantered the mare in circles around Esme, she decided to go the whole way.
Lucy, what are you planning to do?
We need championship with this mare.
In the long run. Strategy, cousin.
Oh.
Lucy halted the mare and sat silently a moment, obviously wondering how much to tell her older cousin. Is she safe? Was written on her face as if with a marker.
I have a reason for asking.
Well, I was going to try for the vet course at the Poly, though Mother wants me to study something more appropriate at the university. I know there is no chance of getting on the estate staff here, but if I qualified, I might somewhere else.
I suspected as much.
I am not just dreaming.
I know that. Get the hump out of your back. You're serious. Just as I was serious. And nobody believed me either. That's why I had the idea.
What idea?
Esme nudged her horse, and it ambled over to Lucy's mare.
As you know, my father gave me a herd. The last thing I need is a herd. But if I try to give it back, he'll be hurt, and I'll hear about it forever.
So?
So, I need someone to manage my herd. Someone who'll make sure that the mares go to the right stallions, that the foals get the right training, and are actually put on the market, and so forth. I would expect to compensate the manager, of course. The eye of the master fattens the herd, and I will be far away for a very long time.
You are thinking of me? It is too much, the mare, and...
I like the way you handle her. It's how I'd want my horses handled, if I wanted horses at all. And since I have them, that's what I'd like. You could save up the money for school. And I know from experience that it impresses them if you fund your own escape. And you'd get the experience.
I'll do it.
Despite herself, Esme thought back to the previous night's conversation. Here was someone for whom prudence could never swamp enthusiasm.
You didn't ask what I'm paying. And you should always find that out first. What it's going to cost and what you're going to get.
It doesn't matter. It's the chance.
It matters. Chances aren't what they seem.
Then, at the look on Lucy's face, she stopped herself. Why was she being negative when she had just been admiring Lucy's impetuosity?
Sorry. Here's what I want from you. A fair accounting of costs and income. Midsummer. That should give you time to write it up after the full crop arrives.
But how much?
You didn't ask before. I'll decide later. Maybe tomorrow.
Esme nudged her mount and started off toward the distant line of trees beyond the canter track. Her cousin followed. After lunch, Esme lingered in the kitchen over a second piece of red nut pie smothered in real cream. A servant entered.
Retired soldier Sebastian Coron, dama, requests a few moments of your time.
She had forgotten about the old man at the reception.
Of course I'll see him.
Esme wiped the last of the pie from her mouth and went out to the hall, where Coron stood at ease, watching one of the younger cousins practice the piano, with Sani standing by. Esme stepped forward to shake his hand.
Reminds me of you, Esme.
It reminds me of hours of misery. The untalented and unrhythmic should never be forced to go beyond learning a few scales. Once we've admitted how hard it is, we should be let off.
Well, you know, it's in the old law.
It was, though Esme had never understood why every child, with or without ability or interest, should be forced through 10 years of musical training on a minimum of 4 instruments. They didn't make all children learn soldiering.
Let's go into the sitting room.
Esme led Coron to the front room, where women of the family usually received guests.
Would you like tea or something to drink?
Without waiting for an answer, she rang. She knew that with his arrival, the kitchen staff would have started preparing the tray with his favorites, whatever they were.